We make assumptions about people. Let me tell you a great story. I have a colleague. He's another writer. And one day he passed me, he was going past a restaurant and I was eating lunch alone in the restaurant. And he came in the restaurant and he looked at me, he said, "Ellen, you don't eat hamburgers." And I was sitting there eating a hamburger. I'm eating a hamburger. And he said, you're not the type, you don't, which is kind of true. But in fact, it's patently false because what he was seeing in front of his eyes was me eating a hamburger. And I thought this is such a great example of assumptions you make about people. They're wrong. And then when they show you to be wrong by the behavior, it doesn't matter. You kind of made these assumptions about them.
Hello, welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn Where We Dispense Wisdom for a Career in Life. That's wisdom for your career in life. My name is Duff Watkins, and I'm your host. Our guest today is Ellen Ruppelscheld, who is an author, writer, investigative journalist. In fact, she's a professor of journalism at Boston University, and she's with us here today. Hi, Ellen. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, Duff.
I have to say, this journey started when I read your book, Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Now, I'm a guy that's been in international business for 30 years, and I can tell you, after reading your book, I will never look at Walmart in quite the same way. It was such a tour de force work at exposing, really, how those everyday low prices that Westerners are so used to, and in fact, feel they're entitled to, how that actually comes about, and in other words, who really bears the cost. I thought that was just a very important book for business.
Thank you.
The other, and I finished also another more recent book called The Job, The Future of Work in a Time of Radical Change. And, oh boy, that too was really good. Talking about the evolving nature of a job, the evolution of a job, and in fact, the evolving nature of work itself. So those are two books I wish to recommend to our listeners and our viewers. Now, which leads me to ask, how do you write about a lot of things? Your articles are published in the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and I see them frequently in the Atlantic Magazine. How do you choose what to write about?
Oh, I think like many writers, my topics kind of choose me. It's generally something that gets in my head and I can't get it out. You know, something that has really bothered me, a question that's gnawing away at me. Something that I find either surprising or perplexing. And in terms of a book, it gives me a very large platform and a lot of time to work out the answers to that question. And when I write shorter things, either I'm offering an opinion or a more condensed opportunity to really investigate topics of concern. My background is in science, and mm-hmm. I started as a science journalist, and I teach science journalism at Boston University, but using this, having some training in science has been very, very helpful in my life as a journalist because you use a similar approach to investigating topics and considering topics, forming a thesis that you challenge. What we call the null hypothesis. You sort of form a thesis. This is what I think, but then you do everything possible to kind of disprove this theory. Okay, so generally speaking, I often go in with assumptions that turn out to be wrong, and that's oftentimes rewarding because the assumptions that we go in with as lay people, uninformed, are often wrong. And what's most rewarding to me is when I find out that everything I thought to be true was not. Mm-hmm. So when these various topics, the things that I've written on, that's oftentimes what their commonality. So when you mentioned Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture, I'm a bargain hunter. I love shopping for bargains. I find it kind of a treasure hunt, and I love it. But then one day, when I was thinking about this, I looked in my closet, and I saw all these garments with the price tag still on them. You know, things, my trophies, right? That I thought, my gosh, I got these at a very good price, but I'll never wear them, right? And it started, I looking at the irrationality of that, led me down that path to really investigating the externalities of low price. So when you're talking about cheap, that's literally how that started, was my own experience. And with my last book, The Job, what was really troubling me was what was happening in the United States. I saw the tremors of what was to come. This is pre-Trump. I was quite concerned about what was going on and the notion that everyone in the United States and in the world, in fact, could just educate themselves into a good job. This was kind of the rhetoric, the prevalent rhetoric out there. And that really worried me. And I didn't know what that meant. And so that led me into this investigation that lasted over 7 years. I looked into that question for about 7 years of what is a job? What does it mean? How does it differ from work? Why is it so central to our lives in the United States that it tends to eclipse almost everything else in our life? And what are the limitations of that thinking? So that's a very long answer to your question, but oftentimes it's another reason I might trip over a story that's just too good to not share with people. So that's another reason some of the things I'm working on now fall into that category.
That's a long answer, but a good answer. Okay. And so that takes us to the 10 life lessons, I guess. Let's start with number one. And this one surprises me, I must say. Number one, trust yourself.
Hmm. Did I say that?
I'll tell you why that surprises me is because, okay, you're a science journalist. Richard Feynman, the famous physicist, he said that in science, you must be very careful not to fool yourself, and you are the easiest person of all to fool. And so when I think of trusting myself, which sounds good, sounds wise, but, and there's always a but to it is what I'm thinking. So that's why I'm interested in your version of trust yourself.
Well, I think that was a pretty flip comment because I always challenge myself. I'm really surprised that I wrote that. You know, again, Duff, let's tell the audience that it's been a while. We've had many aborted attempts to connect. And so it's been months since I think I sent you that list. I guess the only reason I would even think that such a thing could possibly be true is that sometimes casting aside the opinions of others can be very useful, right? And that's happened to me several times in my career. I won't go into it, but often some of the things I've written, especially about science in public health, are quite controversial. But over the test of time, they've turned out to be largely true. And again, part of the reason I think for that is because I go in with assumptions that I'm willing to discard, okay, based on evidence. And again, that comes back to this training I've had in science. You know, you go in again with an hypothesis, but you're not married to that hypothesis. And too often in journalism, which is my field, people go in with a foregone conclusion and stick with it. And it's very important to them to stick with it. And they have to contort themselves into knots to stick with it. I've been liberated by being okay with being wrong. Mm-hmm. So I guess overall, I trust my instincts. But that, like Feynman, he's absolutely right. He put it beautifully. I'm often wrong, okay? Mm-hmm. But I expect I will be wrong. And I'm prepared to be wrong.
I think that's my experience too. I've written articles that were tendentious. I had a point to make when I started. Then when I started interviewing everybody, I found that I was completely wrong. And because the people I was talking to were doing it so well as anything that I could have predicted or suggested or prescribed to them, that it changed my whole it changed the whole article, but for the better. And I started out opinionated and learned a lot in the process, which I think is both good writing and good science and good living, come to think of it. All right, lesson number two, don't take business matters personally. Now, I know how I learned this lesson, Ellen. I'm curious how you learned it.
Well, I'm pretty thin-skinned. I'm not a hard-charging business person. I'm not a business person at all. And as a writer, as you probably know, writers tend to be thin-skinned and a little neurotic. So it was a lesson for me to learn that, and I had a very good friend, a very successful, well-known writer. I was calling him at one point and asking for pity for what I considered to be abuse by an editor who we both had at the time. And I felt I was being singled out for abuse by this editor. And my friend said to me, "Oh no, you're not special. He's just as abusive to me and it's not personal. And I often think about that because I think a lot of the times we feel singled out, that we're getting special treatment, especially bad treatment, right? And in fact, it's simply the way that person operates. And right now in the time, you know, with COVID, I've heard this very, very frequently from colleagues and friends that their responses have been very slow and people are not giving them the time that they think they should. And they think, again, that it's because of them, it's personal. And of course, it's not. And it's often easy to forget, you know, the kind of complexity of other people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. The kinds of things. And I'll give you an example. I was talking to an editor a couple of weeks ago at a publishing house in New York. And he said, I really apologize for getting, you know, having taken so long to get back to you. But today, my middle schooler is starting his first day of school post-COVID. My wife has been through all this. My uncle had COVID, you know, it was one thing after another that he's going through. And of course, I was very understanding and sympathetic. But to be perfectly honest, I was worried that it was something about me. So I think the best policy is always to start by assuming that the other person that you're dealing with does not have anything against you. It's not personal. They may be confused. They may be incompetent, but it's not about you. All right. So I think that's especially important for women. Women tend to take it on quite quickly. Mm-hmm. I know my husband very rarely thinks he's done anything wrong.
But my kind of guy.
right. But many women assume, no matter what they say, that it is them. And so I think that's just something for women to keep in mind. And it's something you have to constantly remind yourself of. It's not one and done. You always have to remind yourself.
It is. It's a lesson that is difficult to learn, that what the world doesn't revolve around me and everything. And you like to think that we graduate from that around somewhere between 14 to 18. But no, it has a legacy. It's in there. And it's hard not to take things personally. It requires a bit of discipline. And as you say, a lot of practice. Now, as for your husband, I'm with him. Just remind him of the famous saying that never attribute to malice that which can be explained by incompetence. And, you know, that's kind of it's hard to live my life by that. It's not me, it's them.
So, okay.
There is some utility about that. But you know, you're talking about editors, and a big breakthrough in my writing was when I realized, just do what they want. Just give them what they want. Give them copy. You know, stop arguing. And lesson number three, and this is a beauty. Demand evidence, and extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Right. So again, this is a, you know, from science. And, you know, if you make extraordinary claims, if you, for example, if you say that broccoli causes cancer, you need to provide extraordinary evidence, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you're going to say, I've now created fusion energy, which has been something that is, you know, scientists have been trying to do for decades. You have to provide extraordinary evidence that you've actually been able to do it. You know, something that's on a continuum, a small step that everyone anticipated was going to happen, you know, the evidence for it would be less demanding than something that is really sort of what pushes against a common wisdom, common thinking, common sense. So let me give an example, something that maybe some of your listeners are familiar with, you know, dieting advice, weight loss advice. You know, it's all over the place, right? And I actually wrote a book about obesity called The Hungry Gene. It was about the obesity gene.
I'm going to find that book and I'm going to read it.
Well, it's old now. It's 20 years old. And what interested me in that was I got interested in that because I was interested in the biological basis of behavior, you know, what biologically can direct our behavior. And this was evidence that eating behavior could be to some degree driven by genetics. And so I was very interested in that, in that mm-hmm. topic. But in the course of researching that book, which was heavy on the genetics and the science, I have obviously encountered a lot of articles and researchers who'd worked in obesity research and dieting research. And it's plagued by bad science, bad reporting, bad everything. It's just a mess. So, you know, obviously, if there's a case in which if someone said to you, well, look, if you take this, pill, if you eat this food, if you do this, your weight will drop off instantly, or you can lose weight without exercising, or you could do these, you'd have to demand extraordinary evidence. You'd have to say, okay, I want to know how this works, why it works, what the, you know, scientific, what the mechanism is of it, what the evidence of it is, what the epidemiology of it is. You'd want all those layers of proof. So that's why it's a demand evidence. These days when people are, for example, unwilling to take vaccines, oftentimes they're doing that without evidence, without good evidence that they should avoid them. Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the other lessons I mentioned later on is that sometimes people simply can't be dissuaded. Facts are not what matter. But if people are open to the argument, then you would want to lead them to an evidence-based argument whenever possible, as opposed to an emotion-based argument, which is hard to do. Our egos get tied into everything.
Well, I was thinking on that, you're talking about vaccines, and I was thinking about people in my hometown. I come from a rural town in North Carolina, although I haven't lived there for half a century. But when I go on Facebook and see how my high school friends, a lot of them are anti-vaccine. And I think, you know, what's wrong with you people? And then I realize that part of the answer is there is a high cost. You have to exert yourself to find out accurate information. And so, for example, when you're talking about extraordinary evidence requires for extraordinary claims, a lot of people just don't know how to go about acquiring that information. I like to think that I do, and I guess you do, but I guess a lot of people, I don't know, you tell me, they either don't want to, or they don't know how to, or they're not open to it. I haven't decided that yet.
Well, I think we live in, to use the word extraordinary again, I think we're living in extraordinary times in which we used to depend on and trust experts to mm-hmm. tell us. Right. The whole idea, when I tell, you know, people extraordinary evidence, I wouldn't suggest that a layperson, you know, try to find the, you know, evidence for black holes, for example, you know, or these very difficult concepts in physics or even whether a vaccination is necessarily safe or effective. I mean, this is where we generally depend on experts to help us understand and to explain to us. And the challenge of expertise, thanks to the internet and Facebook and other places that, you know, some of the, in our country, some of the cable news networks, tabloids, the challenge of expertise kind of tells us we all must be experts. We must all do our own research. And that's really impossible. First of all, many of us are way too busy to do our own research. Mm-hmm. You know, a single mother with two kids and two jobs is in no position to do her own research, you know, nor is a very busy surgeon or many other people, whatever their field, you know, a teacher that's, working very hard to teach his students, right, in the public schools. These folks probably don't have the time or the energy, but most importantly, the time to get on the internet and do their own research. Because when people talk about doing their own research now, it's usually internet research, mm-hmm, right?
Of course.
They're not going around interviewing experts. They're not even going to a library. They're getting on the internet and they're looking. And the internet is a very fickle source. It's all over the place. And trying to figure out what's true and what's not true, that's a hell of a job.
It is.
So I don't blame people if they've lost faith in authorities, the fact that they don't want to or, you know, do their own research. I'm very sympathetic to that.
Yes, it does require a lot of exertion. And that takes us to, well, not quite. It takes us to point number four. question received wisdom.
Right. So again, as a journalist, sometimes the best and most surprising stories that I've run into, let me give you an example. So years ago, I had a graduate student, one of my graduate students came to the United States from Portugal, and he had three children that he brought with him and his wife. And they were moving to the Boston area, and they couldn't get an apartment. And the reason they couldn't get an apartment was because we have laws in Boston about lead paint, okay? So lead paint is toxic. It's a neurotoxin. Yeah. And you cannot rent apartments to children under the age of 6 if you have lead paint in your apartment. Now, Boston's a very old city. Much of the housing stock is very old. And many, many apartments have had lead paint in them over the years, right? So this young scholar was unable to find an apartment, and he came to me and talked to me about it. So that led me into looking into the question of lead paint. Okay. I was very interested in this. I said, wow, that's terrible. Paint is, you know, lead is terrible. Well, anyway, after a few months of researching and talking to experts all over the world, I found that lead paint is not necessarily the main culprit for the high levels of lead Americans had in their blood in the 1970s, the 1960s. It was actually lead in the gasoline, which is still in the soil of many places around the country. So this lead settled on the soil. And if you're living in an area where there's no grass and it's eroded, your children might be exposed to lead in the soil as opposed to lead in the paint. And in fact, the actual poisoning of kids through lead paint in the 2000s was actually really quite rare. Mm-hmm. And so I did, you know, a piece on this for the magazine we have in the U.S. called The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And I have to say the people in the public health community were quite alarmed by this story because they had a campaign about, you know, lead. And, you know, I certainly do not approve of children consuming lead or being exposed to lead. But what I did challenge was the common wisdom that lead paint in houses now in the 2000s was the primary culprit of lead exposure in kids. So again, this came from a personal experience and then really interrogating the question of what were the issues, what were the real issues, and what were the agendas of the various parties involved. We certainly knew the agenda of the lead paint industry, but there was also an agenda on the part of the public health community, because they've been invested in this for a very long time, in this theory. It was very, very hard for them to step back from that theory. Okay, so even the good guys, what we think of the good guys, are often very vested in a certain point of view.
You took on an entrenched interest. You're not the first guest on this show to have done that and to have paid a price for it. Two other examples. One example from your book. In your book, The Job, The Changing Nature of Work, you talked about, you quoted a researcher, Professor Mauro, and I've been in an open office plan. Everybody I know has been in an open office plan. Open office plans have been popular for decades. But according to Mauro and in your book, there is zero evidence that they enhance productivity or that they are in any way better than any other office plan. But I didn't know that until I read your book.
Right. So that's Charles Moreau. He is an ergonomics expert, a designer, an engineer, and exactly right. That is something that was put out there for obvious reasons. I mean, and there's all sorts of reasons why you might want to have an open office if you were a manager or a CEO or an executive. I mean, it's cheaper and it allows surveillance of your employees. And it certainly makes it a lot easier to surveil your employees, mm-hmm. if you have an open office. And in fact, Moreau told me that it can actually have a very negative effect on productivity. And I think what's interesting, we've had almost a what we call a natural experiment here in the United States, because what we found in office workers working from home, the assumption is their productivity would crash. And of course, what we found in this last year and a half is people are actually more productive than they are in the office. So that gives a little credence to Morrow's theory or his observation that productivity is not enhanced by the open office.
Another revelation, according to Ed Zitron, is that the remote work has revealed makes you wonder, what is the purpose of managers? I mean, you can no longer appear to be busy being on the phone, looking stressed. And when the workers are simply doing the work, now the question is, do we need managers?
That's an interesting question. That's an interesting question. But you have to be very careful with that, because these so-called flat hierarchies, which I write about in The Job, are also problematic, right? This idea that there's not a hierarchy, that we're all on the same page. That can be very problematic, because it can lead to ganging up on employees, you know, spying on your colleagues, who has the real authority, because ultimately there always is an authority, right? Even if you don't have a manager, there's the executive suite are the authorities. But I think that's a very interesting question of do we need as many managers as we have? I don't have the answer to that question.
Well, Zitron does, and the answer is no, because the number of managers has exploded. He gives the stats for it. I don't recall it, though I have mentioned it at one time in the past. I have a scientific question for you. This talks about received wisdom. How many chromosomes does a human body have? How many pairs of chromosomes?
There's 23 pairs of chromosomes.
But you know the story. For many years, it was thought to be 24 because the University of Texas scientist Theophilus Painter counted, and he came up with 24, and for 30 years it was maintained to be 24. And then an Indonesian researcher working in Sweden, got to be a story there, who was an amateur photographer, did the research, found out that it was 24, photographed it, and then ever since then it's 23, the actual number is 23, and ever since then we know it's 23. Yet, you go onto Google right now, today, you type in how many chromosomes does a human being have, and you will find page after page after page asserting without equivocation that it's 24, which is the wrong number. It's 23. And to me, this illustrated the potency of that lesson, question received wisdom, because it just ain't always right just because it's been broadcast for 30 years. And all they, I don't remember the Indonesian scientist's name, but all he did was go back and count the pairs in the photographs. He just double-checked. Yeah. And it's arithmetic, right?
Yeah, and that's the danger of the internet, because one of those little mistakes gets magnified and amplified, you know, infinite numbers of, not infinite, but very, very large numbers of times. And so it becomes true. We know if you repeat we know this from our former president, right? That if you repeat a falsehood enough times, it becomes true.
Well, yeah, we know it from Joseph Goebbels, actually, back in World War II, but it reminds me of Paul Krugman calls them zombie ideas. They just go shambling along, brain dead, nothing can seem to kill them. So
that's right.
Good that's movies, right. Poor politics.
Exactly.
All right, lesson number five we're up to. Rise above your assumptions.
Yeah, I seem to be saying the same. I'm so boring. I say the same thing again and again. I rise above your assumptions as we make assumptions. We make assumptions about people. How many, let me tell you a great story. There's a guy, I have a colleague, he's another writer. And one day he passed me, he was going past a restaurant and I was eating lunch alone in the restaurant. And he came in the restaurant and he looked at me, he said, "Ellen, you don't eat hamburgers." And I was sitting there eating a hamburger. I'm eating a hamburger. And he said, you're not the type. You don't, which is kind of true, but in fact, it's patently false, because what he was seeing in front of his eyes was me eating a hamburger. And I thought this is such a great example of assumptions you make about people. They're wrong. And then when they show you to be wrong by the behavior, it doesn't matter. You kind of made these assumptions about them. So I guess I'm hopeful that people are more flexible in their thinking. This guy's name was Mark, and I just it was it was such a funny experience, and I'll never forget it, because it did make me question his writing, what he wrote about others, because he comes in with assumptions about who the person is and then projects them onto reality. So I think we have to be really careful about that.
As Kierkegaard said, once you label me, you negate me. But I do have to wonder exactly what is a hamburger type person. I've got my mind racing now. You know that most people's attitudes, durable attitudes, form between the ages of, six notes, 18 to 25. And I would like to think that they're modified substantially in the next quarter century, because, I mean, if you're hanging on to the same beliefs, opinions, attitudes that you picked up in high school, well, that doesn't say a lot about your spiritual, emotional evolution, does it?
Yeah, it sounds like a boring life, but I it's comfortable, right? So you settle in, between 18 and 25, and you got your way of thinking, and that's the way it is. It doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but it's comfortable. So some people, I guess, seek comfort over fun.
Yes, security over stimulation, yes. I mean, I'm continually amazed at how stupid I was 2 weeks ago, or even 48 hours ago, if truth be known. But therein lies the adventure. I think software engineers have a phrase that your lesson made me think about this. They call it update your priors when they're trying to solve a technical problem. Mm-hmm. What are your prior assumptions you walked into when you faced this problem? You need to update them, because therein will probably be the key to why you're not solving it. So I remember that phrase, update your prior assumptions. You know, good for software, good for everything.
Yeah, I would use a different word. I would say challenge, and have other people help you, because it's pretty hard to update your priors. You know, you're a closed circuit, right? So you need input from outside, right?
Okay, lesson number, closed circuit. Yeah, I tell my wife that. She will appreciate it. She will say, Ellen knows you so well. Lesson number six, be self-confident enough to give others the benefit of the doubt. Now that's a well-crafted sentence, Ellen. Are you a writer or something?
Yeah. Well, I like so many people, I can be defensive and sometimes think the worst, be suspicious of others. And that's usually a reflection of my own insecurity. So I would suggest, I mean, that was a hard learned lesson, you know, how insecure, you know, so many of us are, including me. I never think of myself as insecure. And I think people who know me don't think I am, but I am. And part of that then is judging others too quickly, making assumption about others, and not giving people the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. So it makes your life a lot easier if you do give people the benefit of the doubt. It makes it a lot more pleasant, and it makes it easier. And it also, I think, is usually correct vis-a-vis the kinds of things we were talking about before. You know, let's face it, the vast majority of people are not mean-spirited, are not liars, are not con men and women. You know, they do want to do the right thing. And if you go in with that assumption, or work hard on going in with making that your bottom line assumption, your starting assumption, you'll usually be right. And it also makes your life a lot easier and more pleasant.
It reduces the friction and transactions in life, I've observed. And like you, I mean, it's a lesson I have to keep practicing. But the statistics, the numbers are actually with you on that. I mean, I was reading Steven Pinker's book on enlightenment, and he was talking about the declining rates of homicide in the world. Now, you watch TV and you realize, or you think, that we're living in the most violent age ever. It's not even close. Pinker's research, he's quoting research, all around the world, the most violent places in the world are very few. And it's not in a country, it's in a state. It's not in a state, it's in a particular area, a particular neighborhood. It's not the whole neighborhood, it's a couple of blocks but it's not everybody on the block, it's a few people on the block that are causing all the violence. And I was reflecting upon that. That's pretty much life. It's just what you said. You know, most people just want to get on with it, get along with everybody and enjoy life. And trusting others may be difficult, but ultimately the stats are with you. You're going with the flow.
Right. Right.
Lesson number 7, feelings trump facts on many matters and the rational can be overrated.
Right. So that was what I was talking about earlier about vaccines. People's feelings, their emotional response to things can be very, very powerful. And if you're an empiricist or hyper-rational, which I tend to be, you can underestimate the importance to other people of their feeling, of maybe their spiritual life or their emotional life or their personal history, and how it can color their views. And just throwing facts at them is not going to persuade them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not what they're about. They're not with you. The way, and maybe my job and your job is not to go around persuading people. I see my job not as persuading people, but as on shining a light on things. So if people want to look, they can look, but I can't force them to look. And that's not my job. I don't see it that way. I think too often, you know, we're screaming at the top of our lungs, you know, you're an idiot, you don't understand, you don't get the facts, but that's not even on the table for the other person. That's mm-hmm. that's not what they're talking about. And so you're the idiot because you're throwing facts at someone who's not in that frame of mind. That's not where they are. So you have to respond to, you know, emotional temperature.
I read a book on decision-making, and it was talking about the composition of a decision has a rational and an emotional component. In fact, they were arguing with some neuropsychological research to it that you cannot make a decision without the emotional component. And it made me think about, I'm one of those guys who looks at the election results and say, why are those stupid people voting against their own self-interest? And then it didn't dawn upon me. I read it somewhere. Nobody votes against their self-interest. Everybody votes for their perceived self-interests. And most recently, I read something somewhere that people, there's talking about the U.S., I'll just use that as an example. So many voters in the U.S., it asserted, feel so powerless, feel so that their vote doesn't count. That when they vote, it's not a political exercise, it's an emotional exercise, sort of like a cry out, maybe a shout. And I've been thinking about that the last few days. That makes a lot of sense to me because it's so human. It is so very, very human.
Exactly. No, I agree with you entirely. And I think later I'm going to touch upon what you just said about voting and self-interest, but I'll save that.
Okay. Lesson number 8, you're bored because you're not paying attention.
Right. So I learned this lesson a long time ago. So my first book was built around another article I'd written for The Atlantic about the daycare crisis, childcare crisis in the United States. It was called mm-hmm. A Child's Place. And it was written in a form that's called narrative nonfiction, where you kind of immerse yourself in the experience. So what I was doing at the time, I had a two-year-old daughter, and I would go every week and spend a day at the daycare center. And I was going bonkers. I mean, completely, it was the most boring experience of my life. I just didn't, how was I going to do this? And how could these people stand working with these little children all day long? Now, I adore children, right? Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they are not the most fascinating thing after an hour or two. And then I realized the problem was me, right? Because I wasn't really paying attention. I was watching the clock. I was, you know, wanted to get out of there. I wanted to talk to adults, and I decided I'm going to really do what the teachers do, which is really watch the children and engage with the children. And the day, I won't say it flew by, but so much better. So oftentimes when we're bored, it's because we really aren't paying attention. We're not experiencing the experience. And this sounds very, you know, Buddhist, which I'm not, but being in the moment and really enjoying and trying to enjoy and learn from the moment, as opposed to thinking about the next thing we want to do. As we know, boredom has almost become, it's almost an artifact of a previous century, because now we don't need to be bored because we can pull our phone out and entertain ourselves in any moment. Mm-hmm. But of course we've lost so much by not being bored enough to really pay attention. I think a lot of us intuited this, learned this. I mean, it wasn't just me who learned this at the daycare center. I think many people learn this by paying close attention. The boredom lifts and we can become engrossed, which is the opposite of boredom, right? Mm-hmm. So I just sort of feel that all of us need to step back from our devices if we can and pay attention, and we'll find that we won't be as twitchy and looking for the next thing all the time, which mm-hmm. I think many of us realize we're doing and are very unhappy with ourselves for doing it.
Your comment reminds me of Oliver Berkman, who is was a columnist in the for The Guardian in the UK and an author now living in the US. He was a guest on the show, and he tells the story. I don't know if he told it on our show or in his book, but he went to a Harvard art class. He's a British guy. And the teacher, she assigns her students the same project, same assignment every time. Go to a museum, find a work of art that you like, and observe it for 3 hours. You cannot take your phone. You cannot take paper and pencil. You can't take anything to distract you. And so he did this. And you can imagine. So the first 7 minutes are okay. Then he reckons he's been there for an hour. He looks at his watch. It's 17 minutes more. And he just thought, I just don't know if I can do this. But he did. And he said the more he looked at this work of art, the more he saw, wait, is that the vestige of a ghost image? Wait, is that image a replication of this one? What, that color, that matches that. And it went on. Then after a while, he thought, what time's up? And what a delightful story, and what a wonderful experience it is to have that. And that is the antithesis of what you were describing and what I experience and everyone who's listening to this experiences every day. I need some stimulation. There's the ping of my email. There's, and geez, what a life, which is the subject of his book of 4,000 weeks, by the way.
Yes. That's fascinating. Three hours is a long time. I wonder what the painting was.
He did say, of course, but it can be any painting. Yeah, he did say, and it's probably well known. In fact, it's in Boston, so you would. I don't have a hard copy of the book, so I can't tell you. But
okay, I'm gonna check it out. I'm interested because I've had the experience of being at the Harvard Art Museums and actually standing in front of a painting for a very long time. It's really funny. I completely identify with that. Yeah, he's so right. Mm. Although 3 hours is too long, even for me.
All right, lesson number 9: don't mistake hurt and guilt for anger.
Yeah, well, right. So people, again, if we're talking about work situations, I recall early in my career, I got a colleague who was my boss, very, very, very angry at me. And he was so angry that I ended up crying in his office because he was yelling at me so much. And now looking back at it from a distance, I realized I had actually hurt his feelings, and I didn't mean to, obviously. I was in my 20s and foolish and impetuous and had done something that I think he felt was threatening to him, and, for whatever reason. And I mistook it. It was anger. He was shouting at me, but he was hurt. And I think sometimes people are reacting in that way. And of course, I would never shout back at my boss, but if you did, you'd be missing the whole point, right? You're missing the whole point. He's shouting at you not because he's really mad, but because he cannot express his hurt in a business situation. To tell someone you're hurt or your feelings have been hurt again, I hate to say this, but especially a man to say that.
That's true. It's true. Yeah, I agree.
It's very, very hard, right? So it's sometimes anger. So I think it's really helpful to keep that in mind. I mean, sometimes it is anger, but oftentimes it's not. So it's better to sort those two things out if you can.
It's so true what you said, especially about the male bit. I do a lot of executive coaching in my work, and one of the things I say to the person that's hiring me, I will work with him or her, it doesn't matter, and they will tell me things they won't tell you simply because you're their boss. And they won't, I mean, they might tell me that you're a dickhead or that you're, you know, you offend them or et cetera, but they won't say that to you because they feel they can't. And it's good to be able to express that. And I might help them explore ways to express it to their boss. I'm just saying amen, I guess, to what you just said.
I think it's changing. I know when my children were little, my husband was very reluctant to say that he needed to stay home with a sick child. Okay. Mm-hmm. This was something that really, you know, not in his, you know, portfolio. He was not going to say that. And of course, for me, I thought, you know, if I had something I needed to do, I needed to be on a plane or I needed to, if we had a sick child at home and he was not on a plane, I was hoping he would tell his employer, I've got a sick child at home. Mm-hmm. But that was not something he could do. Mm-hmm. Now, my children are grown. My daughters are grown. And one of my daughters is a parent and her husband is perfectly open to saying that. Mm-hmm. I think it's generational. I think it's wonderful that millennials and Generation Z are able to you know, men are able to do that mm-hmm. a lot more. And so maybe this will all change. Maybe it's all changing.
Lesson number 10, empathy is not compassion.
Right, right. So empathizing and anybody, any of your listeners who have training in psychology probably already know this, but it took me, I don't. And so it took me a long time. I tend to be very empathic. A lot of writers are, you know, but that's very different from compassion. Empathy oftentimes is when you identify with the difficulties someone else is going through, the challenges someone else is going through. And that's good for a writer because you can write it, right? But it doesn't make you necessarily a good friend or a good boss because really, you don't really need to really feel it or really deeply understand it to have compassion, right? So compassion is to forgive the person or be a good listener or be supportive. It doesn't mean that you're feeling it. Those are very, very different things. And I think as a manager, I think that empathy can get in your way. I think you're feeling it. You're maybe even relating about how you've been there too. You know, that doesn't really help the other person. It's not really being compassionate. And I'd say that took me a very long time to learn because I do have this empathic nature, which again is not, I'm not flattering myself. I don't think that's necessarily a positive thing. Mm-hmm. Being compassionate is a positive thing. Mm-hmm. And I've had to work very, very hard on that. And I fail a lot.
Well, you're not the only one. The Dalai Lama says we must practice it because it doesn't come easily. It doesn't come naturally. In fact, he goes further and he says, you need all those dickheads and jackasses in your life. And I say, why, Dalai Lama? And he says, because you need to practice. You're not very good at it. And it's kind of hard to refute that logic because, so, you know, you get so many opportunities to practice and that's how you get better at it. I guess that's how you become the Dalai Lama. And he makes it very clear that, and I think as you said, you haven't said it in so many ways. What you've revealed is that, you know, you have the same emotions and feelings as everybody else, as the Dalai Lama, as me. We all have the same feelings and sets of emotions. There's no difference in sort of the raw ingredients that go into our personality. It's just the salad that gets tossed, taste a bit different, I guess is how I would put that.
Well, I have a long way to go to reach the Dalai Lama's level of compassion, but we can all aspire.
It's like I say, I ain't running for Dalai Lama, so don't hold me to that standard. You know, I'm a day by day kind of guy. I never claimed enlightenment, but you know, that's why we're doing this podcast. Speaking, we've been talking about a lot of things that you've learned. We'll finish up with this, Ellen. Can you think of something that you have unlearned lately? Something that you absolutely positive knew to be true very recently, but and now you've discovered it's just not the case.
Yes, and I think it's great, Duff, you brought it up. And that is what I used to think, which was that this idea among progressives in the United States that people vote against their best interests. And this idea has been out there for a long time. There was a book called What's the Matter with Kansas? And it's written by a gentleman, I think Tom Frank, I think that's his name. And I, when I read that book, must have been, oh my God, it must have been 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought it was wonderful. And I thought it was so insightful. And his premise is that people vote against their best interests. But you're absolutely right. People don't vote against their best, what they perceive to be their best interests. And I think the arrogance on the part of people like me who say that is we think we know what their best interests are, and they're voting against them. And let me give you an example of how this was really hit home for me. When I was doing my last book, The Job, I went to Kentucky and I spent an evening with a family in Appalachia. And I don't know if all your listeners will know about Appalachia, but it can be a very poor part of the United States, the mountains of Appalachia. And this family was a father, a mom, and their kids were mostly grown up. But the father, who was 49 years old, he worked in a glass factory and he made $16 an hour. And he worked in a glass factory that was not unionized. So he's anti-union. And so, well, to the average person, that sounds like he's voting against his best interest. So I was drinking coffee in his kitchen with him and his wife. And I said, so you're anti-union. And he said, you better believe I'm anti-union. And I said, well, why? And he said, because if we unionize this glass factory, the work is going to go straight to Mexico. If they have to pay us more, they're going to close my plant. And he said, I don't know how many years I've got left working in this glass factory. I'm 49 years old. I hope I have a few more years, but I won't have anything else. This is my last job. This is it. I can't afford to have this glass factory move. So that was a real eye opener for me. That's his reality. And he's probably right. There's no law against this company closing and moving to Mexico. There's no law against it at all. Mm-hmm. And after, you know, since I'd written that book, Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture, I'd seen this happen over and over again. And so this guy was right. So simple unionization was not the answer for him. And so we assume he was voting against his best interests. He absolutely was not. Okay. So that was a real lesson to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I would, having consulted the boardrooms for 30 years, I would question the received wisdom of his logic that it would move to, offshore. But what do I know? I mean, I've been in those boardrooms and I've seen the way they make those decisions. And, you know, somebody in London makes a decision to close an office in Sydney, and they have, and they've done it. I've been in meetings where they decided that one company bought another company. So they closed all their wineries, or they took them over. So they don't need winemakers. They don't need the general managers because they got their own. And this is something that I have learned. Suffering can be visited upon you. It has nothing to do with you. Kind of goes back to your point about don't take it personally. It's not about you. It's about the causes arising in the world, to use a Buddhist phrase, and over which you have zero control. Anyway, that aside, but I guess the point is, it's not up to us to be telling them what to think or to feel or how to vote or what's best for them. Because as you say, that is just so patronizing.
It is. Yes, it is.
Well, can I ask you, are you working on another book? What's next for you?
I am. I actually am working on another book. I just sent out the proposal last week. I had my agent do it. so I can't talk about it right now.
Okay. Yeah.
I can tell you, so the book I cannot talk about, but I'm working on some other, I'm doing some magazine work as well. And, most of it's built around environmental issues, aquaculture and seascapes, things like that, which is very appropriate because I spend about half my year now in Maine, which is a seafaring state. And I'm immersed in the questions of commercial fisheries and their decline and things like that. So I've been writing about that quite a bit.
Well, it gives me something to look forward to, the next book. We'll finish here on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, In Essence, It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Our guest today has been Ellen Ruppel Schell, who is author, investigative journalist, and professor of journalism at Boston University. You've heard from us. We'd like to hear from you. You can contact us, email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Tell us what you think. And while you're at it, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, because this is the podcast that's making the world a wiser place, lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening.